Welcome to week 8, Private Practice Bootcamp, and this week is all about forms and policies and record keeping, all of the fun logistical pieces of the papers. And so I guess to get started again, I'm just going to throw it out to the group as far as how is this week for you? Did you have any questions about what you had saw so far? No, pretty straightforward. So the people on the call, did you had any of you had any of this paperwork in place already?
I've in the last couple of weeks I've kind of put together, like, amalgamated a few of the different intake forms that I've used in the past and mm-hmm. done, kind of created something, but I think I might integrate a few pieces that you shared as well within the document that I just created.
Correct. Well, and that's all intakes really are, is a bit of a trial and error and realizing, oh, wait a second, I didn't have that information, or I never asked them that question, and then just constantly updating your intake form and basically grabbing what works.
So
the one that I provided is quite a generic one, I would say. But depending on your individual practices, there's going to be certain questions that you just need to ask in order for you to be able to do your conceptualization or for you to hit the ground running. Whereas for someone else, it wouldn't be that important.
Okay.
How about anybody else? Did you guys have any of your paperwork set up yet?
I didn't. I've been kind of collecting like mm-hmm. samples as I go. So I had an idea, like I have an idea of what mm-hmm. I want to include and what I want to ask people, but I haven't formalized it.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. How about for you, Tanu?
Yeah, I've been kind of collecting samples along the way, just from different places. And mm-hmm. Also kind of have a general idea and gist of what I think might go in and what would be helpful. Mm-hmm. And I guess just in terms of like where I did my practicum at UBC, I felt like they were quite formal and quite official. And so I kind of took that as a good example for what I should have in, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of, yeah, intake and kind of the policy language and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
The policy that I find that I guess the two that are, I would say, are probably some of the most important really are the cancellation policy and your social media policy. Those are really going to be the two that get hit up against the most, I would find. And so just making sure that you're really clear on what that is, and it actually doesn't matter what your policy is. Well, I mean, the social media one, it does, because there's generally pretty strict guidelines on what we can and can't do with our clients. But as far as cancellation policy or late cancel or anything like that, it's just you need to be really clear about what your policy is, and then you need to be really firm in enforcing it. Because that's going to be, you will have more conversations around that specific policy than probably any other policy that you have. So if it's 48 hours, it's 48 hours. If it's 24 hours, it's 24 hours. And the great thing is, as long as clients are informed, you get to make that policy be whatever you want it to be. You know, so for myself, I do 24 hours, but it has to be 24 hours on the previous business day. So if someone has a Monday appointment, they actually have to cancel on Friday mm-hmm. or else they're responsible for that. And I charge a full session fee. So it's a pretty big hit to the wallet if somebody decides to late cancel on me. Pretty well always, I do kind of a half price, get out of jail free. So if it's the first time, I'll usually say, okay, you know, normally it's full price, this time it'll be half price, but, you know, going forward, and then I'll make sure to make a note of that somewhere in their file that they've used up their freebie in some ways. Because for some clients, it will start to become a bit of an issue. And so it's just good that you've recorded that, yes, that conversation's happened, and yes, they are aware of the policy. And I have my cancellation policy written right in my reminder email that goes out to people. So every single time they get a reminder, they also get my cancellation policy. So again, there's no way for that they would be able to say, oh, I didn't know, because the reminders go out well before 24 hours in advance. So there's lots of opportunity for people to cancel.
Is the thinking that, like, by them giving you 24 hours notice that you could potentially fill that hour within 24 hours?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, and that's where if it's 24 hours, usually if it's the day before, mm-hmm. I can usually scramble. Like if I know somebody has want, like I'll often have people circle around certain spots where they're like, if you have anything opening up in the evenings this week, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. Or if you have anything opening up on a Tuesday, I'll take it or whatnot. So I just have a list of people that I know, okay, if that person moves, that I'm going to move this person. Mm-hmm. But so there's that side where you can actually hopefully fill the space, which is why some people say 48 hours because they really want ample mm-hmm. time to do that. Mm-hmm. I find 24 for me has been fine, but everybody's practice is going to be a little bit different. For me, where I find it's really comes in handy is just for my own life planning. Of if I know someone's canceled, so if I am seeing, let's say, 4 clients in a day and my 3rd client of the day cancels, I generally call my last client and ask if they can come in earlier.
Right.
Or I might try to just shimmy people around just a little bit. Obviously, I don't do that all the time. I mean, and I always give people the option of you can keep your original time, or if it works better for you, you could come in a little bit earlier and then go home a little bit earlier. And mm-hmm. but given the extra time, then they can move their schedule around often, and I can move my schedule around, and it just means that everybody can live their lives accordingly. But that's the one where if you're not really clear on the policy and people don't know about it, it will often come as a bit of a shock to people of, what do you mean? You know, but my meeting, I got called into a meeting at work and I didn't know about that 24 hours ago. And mm-hmm. And that's really unfortunate. However, well, this time was actually for you. So in some ways it's not actually my problem. You had asked for this time, and obviously I would never say it like that to a client, but just understanding like that the space was reserved for you. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm pretty hardcore on my cancellation policy. I know a lot of people have a lot more exceptions mm-hmm. to their policy than I do. And again, it's just a personal choice for me, unless it's something that is truly completely unavoidable, as in like death in the family type thing. I'm expecting people to come in because I offer Skype sessions as well. So if someone says that they're sick, I mean, if they're obviously like deathly ill and just non-functioning, then no. But if they're saying, oh, like I have a bit of a cold, I didn't go to work today, I just offer a Skype session. That's fine. We don't need to get each other sick, but we can still have our session. Mm-hmm. So this time is for you. Mm-hmm. And I actually find I've only once had someone not take me up on it. Generally, people are actually pretty happy because usually they're, even if they're sick, they're still happy to talk and they're still happy to do some work. Right. It's just a matter of they might not want to leave the house. Mm-hmm. So, but just knowing that that's going to be the one that you really need to get clear on what are your exceptions. And depending on the clients you work with, like I know a lot of people who work with kids. Hi, Janine.
Hi.
A lot of people who work with kids, that will often, you'll need to make certain adjustments for it because, some kids, but if you work with parents who have young children, again, there's often that piece of what happens if something happens with the kids? What are the expectations? So just with the policies, it's really you're wanting to think about what are the worst case scenarios? What are all the variations of how this might be used? So that way when someone's asking or if it's happening in the moment, you're not processing in the moment of is okay or am I okay? You actually instead can just say, well, these are my exceptions or this is what this is and I'm sorry. And it's hard. I mean, I've had clients who've canceled with 23 hours notice, and I've still had to say, well, it was within the 24-hour window. And sometimes they'll get mad. And if you're just really firm about it, you know, I totally appreciate the frustration, and, you know, I have to draw the line somewhere. Again, I think I've maybe lost one or two clients over the last 5 years because of it, where they've gotten upset about it. And generally it was clients who were already having some issues with boundaries. So it was actually, there were therapeutic signs that was going to happen as well. Whereas most people are pretty reasonable. If you say, this is the policy, this is the deal, this is how I make my living, and at this point it's going to be very hard for me to fill that space. People are generally pretty good about it. But, and also for your practices, figuring out what do you want your cancellation fee to be? Yeah. I would say I charge full price. I know some people who charge half price, some people who charge just a flat rate fee that's much lower than that. I mean, it's what feels like it's compensating you for the time that you're losing and also is reasonable for your clients. So has anyone thought about what their cancellation policies would be at this point, or what you think they would be?
I was thinking full, like the mm-hmm. session fee, that's yeah. seems to be fairly typical. And my question is, have you ever had issues collecting it though?
I generally haven't. Mm-hmm. I've probably had to write off maybe 5 sessions in 5 years mm-hmm. where the person just didn't come back. Mm-hmm. I've had times where people have come back 2-3 years later to pay for a session. Now they want to come back and they know they owe me. I try to just believe in humanity that, I mean, people know if they knew that was the policy, if it wasn't a surprise for them, and then they know that they didn't follow through on what the agreement was, people generally know, okay, that's just how that's going to work. Yes. It's going to depend a little bit on the clients that you work with. So for me, I work with addictions, but in my private practice, I'll only work with alcohol and pot addiction. I won't work with any of the harder drugs because that was starting to become an issue. Because often people would relapse, or somebody else was paying for their sessions, and then they would just not show up, and I would have no way of sometimes contacting them or collecting. And so it was starting to be a lot of work for sessions that weren't actually happening. So I just don't work with that anymore. Whereas I know people who do still actively work with kind of any addictions. And what you can do is, you can use credit cards for payment, and then you can actually get your clients to sign an agreement saying, you know, this, I understand that if I late cancel within this time frame, that I give you permission to charge my card, and then you would be able to just charge their card, whether they came in or not. Mm-hmm. The downside of that is, of course, anyone can cancel their credit card at any time. Mm-hmm. But that's also a lot of hassle, and if people have signed a contract and they know that that's coming, then they generally don't care. But yeah, overall, I haven't found it to be a problem, but it's everyone's going to be a little bit different just depending on the clientele that they see. Mm. Yeah. But I just find that the more that you have those conversations with people and just that it's not a surprise, then they understand the consequences if they do have to late cancel.
Yeah.
Oh. That one and another, the late client policy, you're probably not going to use very often, but it's that same thing of how long would you wait for somebody? And that one for me showed up because of a lot of the addictions clients that I was working with, where I wasn't able to tell, like, are you just running late or are you just not showing up? And particularly if you see clients late into the evening and you just want to go home, it's good to have some form of policy of at what point are you no longer going to run a session for someone. If there's only 10 minutes left in a session, would you still sit down and do 10 minutes of a session with somebody? Or are you saying, no, this is a late cancel at this point? Mm-hmm. We're just thinking through.
Yep.
Great. Yeah. So any other questions about any of the forms or any of the policies?
I was wondering when you cover your social media policy. So did you cover that like verbally on intake or is it written somewhere?
It's in my informed consent form. So in the template that I gave you guys, there's just a little blurb where like insert here, which is where it is in mine. And it's basically around the communication piece in there. And it's just letting people know it's not personal. I just don't accept friend requests on any social media platform. And if you want me to look at something on your social media, we'll just have to have a conversation around the impact of that. Because sometimes you will get people saying, oh, like, look at this thing or look at this post or, you know, so-and-so didn't like my thing. Or it's amazing how much you will talk about social media if you do couples work. Mm-hmm. It pulls up a lot. and just having that we'll have a conversation before I'll look at something to just talk about the ramifications of me looking at any of their social media, but that we won't be linked. I won't link to anything of theirs.
Okay.
Have you had people trying to add you on Facebook or on?
Not really. And I think it's probably just because I hit that right out of the gates up front of that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Where I find I do get asked a lot, just because a lot of the clients I work with are executives, where I'll often get asked to link on LinkedIn.
Oh, yeah.
And again, it's just, it gets muddy because then you might have someone who's now recommending you or it's just, and it's tough. I've had some people who are like, I know that you don't really, but I would really love to. Like, yeah, I know, me too. It'd be great. Like, but we can't. So LinkedIn is the one that I find I'll often have to have that conversation again. And also because LinkedIn will often just mass email anyone that's on someone's mailing list. So I will, I'll often get those from people, but most of the time if I check in with them, if it's an existing client, I'll just talk about it at our next session of, hey, I noticed that. And I would say half the time they're like, oh, I didn't even really mean to do that. It just sent it to everyone on my list. And for some people it was intentional. And we just talk about why.
Can I ask? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say with Facebook in particular, well, and with most of the platforms, I actually have two accounts for anything social media related. So I have one that's my name that people can find me on. And then I have one that's kind of an acronym that you'd have to know what it was in order to find it. I keep my social media presence pretty tight anyway, just because ultimately anyone can screen grab anything. So especially when you're a personal brand, you have to be just that much more mindful of what's online and just keeping that online presence clean. Because as much as we'd love to say, well, this is me, my professional self, and this is just me being me, ultimately we don't know who can see what. And there's always that aspect of representing the profession, even when we're off the clock. We don't necessarily want to be like, oh yeah, that was the therapist who, you know, I saw doing the tequila shots over blah, blah. Like, want to go party, go to Mexico. or do it with friends with no cameras.
But that was my question. You just read my mind. I was going to ask the group about their, you know, what they did for security measures or for social media.
That's what I do, and I find a lot of therapists do that, where they'll have one, because I find it's a really powerful tool for networking, and especially like Facebook is starting to be more of a business tool now, whereas it's less personal because people realize that it's not, when they put anything out there, basically everyone can see it regardless of how tight your security measures are. So it's something that I do recommend people have a presence on there, but have one that is your professional presence. And not necessarily like you as the therapist, but it's just the one that is your more professional one if you were going to be connected with other businesses or because there's also a really, it's a really great wealth of information as far as finding out information about your ideal clients, because there's so many groups on various topics that you can join these groups and you'll actually be able to see in real time the questions that people are asking or the concerns that people have. And so it's a really great way to connect to other professionals that are doing this kind of work, or professionals who are in supporting industries. It's one that I think it's still worth being on there in a professional capacity, but just keeping your personal stuff elsewhere.
Yeah. Or no, that's a good idea.
Using it personally.
Cool. Perfect.
How does anybody else address that? Do you guys have separate profiles, or do you use social media very much?
I use, I have a Facebook account, and I think I would probably have a Facebook page for my counseling business when I start it, but I don't post really anything personal on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and you bring up a really good point, or kind of a good topic maybe we can touch on with social media is, this is more soapbox fact. I really don't think most therapists need Facebook pages.
Mm.
And the reason for that is you're never going to get clients from it. But if you like being on social media, if you like Facebook, if you enjoy just finding articles and sharing them,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. But if you're looking at it as a way to really advertise your practice, I don't know a single person who says that there's actually a return on investment. And your time is an investment. Even if you're not, even if it's free, if you're having to spend an hour a day on Facebook to get any reach. And the way they have the algorithms now is it's based off of engagement. So even if you send it out to 400 of your friends and all 400 of them like your page, but only one or two of them ever actually go to your page and read things, it doesn't matter. Like they'll really suppress the reach. They're making it's much more of a paid platform now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you actually want anyone to see anything that you put out there, you generally are paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's where, okay. I mean, if you like Facebook, I started a Facebook page for the business of helping, because I'm basically experimenting with it right now. And it's really interesting because I'm not paying for anything. So I'm just doing it purely organically just to see if someone doesn't pay what the reach they can get. And it's surprisingly low.
Mm.
Whereas before, when it first started, you'd put one thing out and everybody who liked your page would see it. Whereas now, sometimes only two people will see an article. They'll only put it in two people's feeds. So it's a lot of energy. And to actually make it worthwhile, you're going to be spending a lot of money and a lot of time. And generally, social media is not where people are going to find therapists. They go to where the therapists are, which are the therapy directories. And we'll talk about that more in the... I guess it's next week in Existing Online. We'll be talking about the various directories and things like that you can be on. But it's generally not Facebook. You might ask a friend, but I don't know anyone who would go to a therapist's Facebook page to figure out if they like them or not. They would go to the website. They would ask a trusted advisor. They would go anywhere else, but they're not going to go to Facebook and Google therapist and then just start finding people that way. The only reason that I find that it can be useful is if your business model or your business plan involves media or online work, sometimes it's beneficial to be on there because you've at least established that there are people who are comfortable with technology. So if you're offering online services and it's something where they would have to be comfortable with technology, you've at least ticked one of those boxes. And again, for media, or if you want to do a lot of writing, it's a way that media outlets may look to find people, but it's not somewhere where clients are going to look to find people.
Okay.
So kind of make a page if you want a page, but don't feel like you... In order, if you have a private practice, you should have one, because it's actually worse to have a page that is stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
I find when I look at most therapists, because with my business page, I'll go around and I always like, basically, if you're a therapist and you have a page, I'll go like it just because I feel like we need to spread some love. But most of the pages that I find, people haven't posted anything in over a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they started their practice, they threw up a couple articles, and then they got bored with it. But now this presence is still online, in some ways gathering dust, which actually is worse for you than not having one at all.
Mm-hmm.
So something to think about. And also if you have Facebook pages, the social media policy becomes even more important because then there starts to be this blurry line because it's you online presenting yourself as a professional. Whereas if it's just your personal Facebook page, a little bit easier for people to understand that like, this is my personal space and that's your personal space. Whereas when we're online presenting ourselves as a professional, people often feel like, okay, great. I'm going to comment on your page. Or then you get people saying, oh, you know, she's my therapist too, and I love her, or so people messaging you, and now all of a sudden you have someone who's now messaged you through your Facebook page asking for help or asking for services, and then what do you do with that information if you have no way of actually contacting them because they haven't actually, so now you're in a message exchange with someone on Facebook, which of course is not really that secure. You know, it opens up a lot of, a lot of other, a lot of other issues.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, I never even thought of that.
most people don't. You're not alone. Usually the look that I'm seeing from all of you on the call is usually the look I get from people. Like, have you thought about it when this happens? They're like, no. Thing that felt like a great idea, maybe not. it just starts to get blurry,
right?
Social media,
yeah. So, yeah,
you know, Twitter not as much, just because it's a little bit more like a mouthpiece of, if you just want to say, here are the things I think, and anyone can follow you. Again, there's a potential that someone is going to try to private message you through that, so you may still run into that a little bit there, but the fact that people can follow you without you having to follow them is a little bit better. But again, you're still going to run into that potential of someone, they're the best, they're my counselor, or blah blah blah. So yeah, I would not that route unless you like it. Like, I know some people, I'm hoping actually Julia's on the call next week. I know she's on holidays right now. Because Julia is prolific on Periscope. She's on there all the time. And she just does it because she loves it. She just really enjoys the medium. She likes the community. She likes to just, and she's big on Twitter as well. So, you know, and it's not that she's doing it because she's actively using it to try to build her practice. It's because she just really likes being on social media and really loves sharing that information in that way. No, which is great. You know, so if that's what you want to do, by all means, but don't feel like you have to do it in order to have a successful practice.
What's Periscope?
Periscope, it's newer. So don't feel bad if you've never heard of it, because it's kind of a weird one. It's basically live video streaming via Twitter. So you can, you know, just turn your camera on, basically talk into your camera. But if you say, oh, go to my Twitter feed, it'll actually be the live video that's streaming directly to your Twitter feed.
Oh.
Yeah. Or someone can actually just follow you on Periscope and actually watch it. So I follow Julia on Periscope, and so it's my phone is constantly blowing up with her. Like, who's doing a Periscope? So, she's a very good person to ask if you're interested in that.
Cool.
But again, like, you don't actually have to do any of that. But if you do anything on social media in a professional capacity, you're really going to need to have a lock solid social media policy, because then it's essentially we're stepping into that arena.
Yeah.
So, have any of you decided, as far as texting with your clients, where you stand on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just set a policy for some of the contract work that I'm doing. I'm working with a lot of children and youth who are at risk and love using their phones.
Yes.
And I have put in my consent and confidentiality form that I'm only use my phone for or texting for appointment reminders and don't use it for anything other than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's where I am with it. I was kind of like, oh, it's kind of a, I could see it being a useful tool, but I'm kind of concerned about opening up a can of worms and just, and I've been really clear because I've got a work cell phone because I'm doing outreach. It's like, been really, really clear about my hours that my cell phone is on. And then I ended up getting another cell phone just for work. And then I turn it off as soon as I leave. And that's it. And then, yeah. And have those policies on my answering machine, on my consent form. And it's kind of the first thing I talk about with you in my intake. So, and it's been good. People have been really receptive and they get it. Yeah.
Great. How about anyone else? Where do you stand on texting with clients?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way that Courtney does, that I feel like texting, you kind of, when I text people, I expect an immediate response. Yes. And so I can imagine that clients would expect that as well. So I think it's kind of a slippery slope that you just really need to be clear about. I don't think, I don't think I would engage in that kind of conversation, because it's like, how long can it go on for, and how do you put parameters around that?
Yeah.
Or bill for it. How would you bill
exactly,
for it?
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So I think it's probably just best to say, yeah, we don't do it. I don't do it.
Yeah. Now everyone lands in a different place with texting. And I find it tends to parallel their availability for clients. You know, I do know some therapists who, if a client calls them at 9 o'clock at night, they will pick up their phone. I'm not that therapist, but I do know some people where it doesn't matter if it's a Saturday morning. It doesn't matter when, if it's a client calling, they will pick up the phone. That's setting an expectation with clients that you are consistently available. And I find that often, if that's kind of your stance when it comes to availability, generally those practitioners are more open to texting back and forth with clients. For me personally, I have a no texting policy with my clients, and I actually can't really stop them from texting me. But I just like, if someone texts me, I respond with an email. So I'll never respond to a text message from a client, and then I just always remind them of, actually, you know, the fastest way to get in touch with me is by email, and then I'll respond to you the next day, if it's in the evening, or just so they don't ever get the sense of, because once you have that information, you know, like you were saying, there's almost an expectation of, now you're going to do something with that information. I just tell people that is not the way. If you want to write words, email me, and then I'll get back to you within 24 hours.
Do you find that clients ever email you with like actual concerns that you would normally talk about in a session, like as a heads up for you or something, or like, are they looking for, I don't know.
I'm again, I mean, this, it comes down to your policies. I'm pretty firm on, you know, feel free to email me, and I let people know. Again, I mean, email is not 100% confidential, so just keep that in mind that with whatever you're sharing with me. But I tell my clients, like, you are absolutely welcome to email me whatever you'd like to email me, and then we'll talk about it in session.
Right.
So I generally don't respond unless it's something about changing an appointment time or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's just someone saying, you know, I realized this, or I wanted to talk about this, I might write back with just like a one line, thanks, we'll talk about it next week. Or sometimes I don't respond, depending on the client. We'll often set up a bit of an arrangement of how I'm going to respond, depending on if it's something that I've invited them to do, or if it's something that they're just doing on their own. But, and then I just follow the same policy. So, and something that I've done just more, it was a way to train my clients to not expect responses, is I generally will respond to emails only at the end of a day. So even if I've got the email and I have the time in that moment, I'll still wait until the end of the day to respond, just so there isn't this all of a sudden that cause and effect of, oh, I email and 5 minutes later I get a response. And people start to expect that. So I batch all of my emails at the end of a day, sit down and just respond to everybody. It generally only takes 10 to 15 minutes depending on how busy the email's been. And then same thing, like if anything's coming after that, I sit down in the morning and I'll respond to everyone. So I generally respond to emails twice a day, just so there isn't an expectation that, well, I wrote you and then you wrote me back 5 minutes later and then I wrote you back right afterwards and then you didn't respond for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I had 2 minutes in between sessions to respond to the first email, but then I couldn't get to that other one until later. Yeah. So just for consistency's sake, I try to batch it, and that seems to work for me. For other people, they respond right away because their inbox gets so full that, like, by the time the end of the day rolls around, I'll have missed half of them. I mean, there isn't a right way. It's just figuring out the system that's going to work for you.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, and just something that Courtney and I were talking about before everybody else was joining, as far as note taking in private practice, especially for anyone who's worked in agencies, there's often a bit of unlearning that needs to happen when it comes to your record keeping. Is just less is going to be more as far as your clinical notes are concerned. Because ultimately there's therefore no other purpose other than yours, and it's just to keep you on track and just have a bit of a record of what it was that happened in the session, which is different than when you're working in agencies when you might have 5 or 6 different people accessing the same files and needing to have a really clear sense of what happened in all of those sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Because from a cover your butt perspective, if your records are subpoenaed, you would need to be able to stand behind whatever it was that you wrote. And especially in private practice, if your records are subpoenaed, it's usually coming from a custody battle or a divorce proceeding or something, or an ICBC case. And so often the less you write, the more you have the option of sharing what feels appropriate. If you were to have to, if they were to say, well, what did you mean by this? Then you can actually say what you meant by it. Whereas if you have extremely detailed notes that may or may not be the entire full story, often it can kind of bite us or our clients in the butt. Because sometimes clients will actually want to, they'll ask their lawyer to get their record subpoenaed, thinking, well, whatever my therapist wrote is probably going to support my case, which may or may not be the case. There may be something in there that might not support what they're wanting to do. So I find less is generally better, which is usually a bit of a mind shift if you're coming from an agency perspective.
Mm-hmm. I have a question because I've heard this often, but do you ever run into difficulties with not remembering what you're referring to in your notes where you're so sort of vague that you don't actually?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Not generally. I mean, again, it's going to depend on how you work. I generally come from a perspective of the details are mostly irrelevant. I really try to stay much more in the process of what we're happening. And so that's what my notes are about I use a bit of a format where it's basically like, what's the issue today? And then what did we do about it? What was the outcome? And then what are the next steps? And so most of my notes, I would say, are anywhere from 3 to 5 sentences.
Okay.
And that's it. And again, obviously, if it's something that's a little bit more detail oriented, if someone's recounting, say, an assault, and I don't want them to actually have to go through those details again in detail, but it's probably important for me to know names and dates and times and things like that, just so they don't have to repeat them again, I'll obviously write something a lot more specific there. But if it's just someone coming in and we're processing something that we've been processing for a while, often they'll just say, you know, was processing family dynamics and specifically XYZ.
Okay.
You know, and sometimes it happens, of course, where you're like, huh, what did that mean?
I think I was wondering, I'm wondering less sort of in the context of a session and more like if your records were subpoenaed, if you would ever kind of run into trouble with.
There's always the option of I don't recall.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And we can't remember something we don't remember.
Yeah.
And it's actually better to say I don't recall.
Yeah.
Than trying to make up a story of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, you know, for me, the important pieces are more about the process of what we talked about and less about the details. So as far mm-hmm. as that specific detail, I don't recall.
Okay.
And that's all we can be is honest. But the problem with details is if they're taken out of context.
Okay.
You know, so we just need to be really careful about if we're putting down details, they're somewhat indisputable as standalone pieces. And that we're just really clear around that this is what the client stated, this is what the client reported. And just that's where I find therapists tend to get themselves in trouble when it comes to a court subpoena, is it was vague about where the information came from.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's coming from the client, just making sure they stated, they said, they reported, whatever. Mm-hmm. If there's any kind of diagnosis, again, that it's really specific where that diagnosis came from. Is that from their doctor? Is that from a psychiatrist? Is that the client self-diagnosed? So like, because if it's not and we have it written down, the implication is that we have now diagnosed them with something. So just making that piece really clear. And then something that I do in my notes is I put, I know my short code to myself is if I start a sentence with disgust, or explored, I know that I did that versus they brought it into the conversation.
Okay.
So it's just my, if I started it with reported, stated, whatever, I know it's because they specifically said that and I'm just writing that fact down. Whereas if I say discuss this, it's because I decided I was going to go somewhere with it and I brought that concept into the room. Yeah. So you'll start to, in your notes, develop a little bit of a code for yourself. Mm-hmm. Like I know if I ever see a number with a circle around it, that's an age. You know, just those little pieces like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the courses I took actually was, I was trained in the Kinsey interview, basically the sexual history interview, and mm-hmm. the whole thing, you actually do the whole thing in code.
Mm-hmm.
And because obviously I do a lot of sex therapy, that was one of the things that we were actually taught how to do, was actually how to write your notes in code. So therefore, basically, you could make your code mean whatever you wanted your code to mean if someone ever asked you about it. Just it's especially, and that came out of obviously times gone by when if somebody was saying I'm homosexual, you know, that could lose them their job, that could lose them everything potentially. So unless that was actually the fact that was important, if someone was getting subpoenaed around something to do with a workplace, that piece of information was actually not relevant. But the fact that it was in your notes could be detrimental for someone.
Yeah.
So when it comes to record keeping, I mean, obviously all the associations are going to have different stances on it. Every different orientation is going to have different ways, the different pieces of information that are going to be important. But it's, for me, I always just come from that place of less is more. You want to have enough that you know what you talked about, but vague enough that you can basically present it in a way that is going to be in the best interest of your clients
mm-hmm.
if you were ever to have to say something about it.
Yeah.
So I'd rather be the one making the decision on the spot as opposed to someone just reading my notes, assuming they knew what it meant, and then making that mean something for my clients.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that's kind of where I stand on that one. Okay, so as far as forms and policies go, any last quick questions there? No? Okay. I've noticed that there's been kind of a flurry of activity in the group, which is great, with people putting in their stuff from past weeks, and just keep doing that. I've been going in and kind of offering some suggestions for things that are there. And I'm actually going to go in. I wasn't able to this afternoon update my calendar, so I'm going to try to do that tonight. So by tomorrow morning, for any of you that haven't booked your one-on-ones yet, I know Carmen and I, we have a few. So gotta get in there and start using those.
Yeah, it's true.
That link will be updated for tomorrow, and then you guys can start booking those so we can start digging in to all of your copy. Next week is going to be existing online. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about the websites and things like that. So we're going to start pulling a lot of the writing materials that you've been doing up until now, and we're going to start plunking them in a little bit. Cool. So building the structure of your sites a bit.
Cool.
Wow. Perfect. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Constance.
Great.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.